You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with James Fishkin, director of the Deliberative Democracy Lab and author of Can Deliberation Cure the Ills of Democracy? This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
The three ills of democracy that I propose to address with this method that we've perfected now over the last several decades in maybe 160 elaborate projects are, first, democracy is supposed to make some connection with the quote-unquote will of the people. But how can we estimate the will of the people when everyone's trying to manipulate it? The public is subjected to misinformation, disinformation. Our public sphere has decomposed into filter bubbles or enclaves where people hear like-minded voices because they find them congenial. Algorithms of social media make that convenient to get information that way. So finding the will of the people is the first problem. The second problem is that the way our political communication systems have evolved, we get more and more extreme partisan polarization, and the divisions have become seemingly intractable. And those divisions lead to deadlock and a perception that democracies cannot get anything done, or people at least lose faith in democracy. That's the second big problem. The third big problem is that for democracy to function, citizens need to make a connection between their considered judgments about what needs to be done and what the parties are offering in elections. But our voting patterns become more and more tribalistic based upon identity. People will support their party right or wrong, and they won't think about it. Party membership for leaners, even for supposed independents, most independents are leaners one way or the other. It's the party identity that is decisive. We need more deliberative voters, voters who will think about the issues and exercise their choices based upon the issues and not merely party loyalty. This has been argued to be a folk theory of democracy that's a kind of idealistic pattern that used to be celebrated. It's part of our folk wisdom, but it never happens. It's as rare as a unicorn. Well, we have shown with applications of deliberative polling in controlled experiments, some of them national, some of them quite visible, some of them televised, some of them featured in major media like the New York Times and others, that the design of organized deliberation solves all three of these. So then the problem is, what do you do with that? Is there some way of scaling it? And I would say first, there are many occasions when deliberative polls by themselves have been used to solve major public problems at the national level and at local levels and in various parts of the world. And those are very interesting developments because many of them were unexpected. But secondly, there's no reason why the deliberative process could not be scaled. You don't need a constitutional amendment for it, which a constitutional amendment in my country, in the U.S., is almost impossible to get, as you know. But it's a question of collective political will if we would like to scale it, and it has lasting effects. So I want to spread deliberation in the schools. I want to spread it for certain important occasions, maybe national elections. There can be mass deliberation, and we've created a platform working with Stanford colleagues here in engineering, which has now been used in about 60 countries around the world in various languages, even for a global deliberation. So it's been used, and it's very effective and cost-effective, and it does exactly the same thing as with human moderators. We have found, secondly, that the supposedly intractable divisions between our political parties considerably diminish when people learn to listen to each other and their concerns. Now, if you just confront them with a different point of view, it may backfire. But if you have a civil discussion where over time people learn to listen, they open up and they begin to actually consider the point of view of the other. And thirdly, we have found that even a year later, after one of these experiments, people vote according to their considered judgments that they've arrived at. And we've found that on a number of issues. And we published this in the American Political Science Review. We published it in Perspectives on Politics. We published it in the major academic journals. And those conclusions are featured in my book. So it's not a myth that voters can do this. Now, you say voters are ill-informed. Yes, they often are ill-informed because of rational ignorance. If I have one vote in millions, why should I pay a lot of attention? Particularly when I know everybody's trying to sell me something or manipulate me. Why should I pay a lot of attention? Because most of us are too busy. We have to earn a living. We have to provide for our families. And the complexities of public policies are such that it's rational not to spend too much time on it. However, if you get them to focus, they are perfectly competent to deal with the issues facing their communities and their countries. That's the difference. It's not that they're already informed, but if you have one voice in a sample of 1,000, which has been divided up into small groups of 10, your voice matters in that small group, and you feel engaged to listen and to think about the issues, particularly if you've got a good digest of the pros and cons and an opportunity to question competing experts, and that's part of our process too. So that's an outline. The hardest part is the scaling, but even if we don't end up scaling it, we could do a great deal of good to clarify what the people really would think. The book ends with a whole bunch of different applications for deliberative processes. And here's the trick. Each of them is justifiable, but if you could do all of them, you would end up with a more deliberative society. You'd end up changing the way people relate to each other across difference. And you'd end up creating the habits of citizenship, which would lead to better public decisions. A whole bunch of specific policies that might address climate issues. We had about 70 of them. And on almost all of them, the Republicans moved on that. So the idea that people are intractable in their views is misleading. If you put them in an environment where they have a civil dialogue and they reexamine the implications of their views and they get their questions answered and they have an opportunity to listen to some of the people who may be affected by some of the choices, they will often move substantially. And that ends up depolarizing our differences. If people had the habit of self-critically thinking about the issues, and if they had more opportunities to talk to others who had different points of view in a civil way, instead of just shouting at them, we could end up with a more deliberative society. Well, my colleague, Alice Sue, has been leading an effort to bring deliberation to the schools and to universities around the country, and in universities in other countries as well. And a lot of these projects are on our AI-assisted platform because that makes it easy and also allows us to have projects where students from different parts are in the same small groups deliberating. But sometimes just in a given school system as well, we've done this. And we also had, working with the Close Up Foundation in Washington, D.C., we also brought a national sample of young people to Washington to consider how they were going to vote. This is last summer before the election. And we had a great sample from the nation's 40,000 high schools. We selected these people. And I must tell you that their enthusiasm had completely consumed the briefing document. We also have a video version of the briefing document as well to make it clearer and maybe more easily accessible. But they didn't need that. They knew everything. They engaged intensively. And they changed their opinions on many of the same issues that the adults did in the original American One Room 4 years earlier. Decisions of the people are usually quite smart, even in places where the level of literacy is low. Indeed, we think we had an effect on child marriage, on the education of girls, and on public health things like in Ghana, they were using untreated wastewater for gardening because there was a water shortage, and they found other ways of finding water, rainwater harvesting, and being more efficient with the use of water to prevent disease. So the people, if given collective choices and options, will make not only sound decisions, but they will have reasons for those decisions. Now, we need that everywhere. So deliberative democracy is itself, when properly done, a kind of democracy that can speak to the interests of a community. And we need that all over the world. Before things tightened up in China, we were even doing projects in China with local governments, one of which was featured in Time magazine. And we published the results in the major journals. So I think that all these cases are instructive. But in order to save democracy, people have to believe in it. When they deliberate, they tend to believe more optimistically that democracy can be made to work. I'm sort of like a Johnny Appleseed spreading this message around the globe when the opportunities arise. And I'm going to Mongolia in May for a celebration of 10 years of deliberative polling in Mongolia. And it's the only place in the world that actually has a law requiring that they do it for changing the constitution. And the last change in the constitution brought in a change in the electoral systems. Mongolia is a relatively recent democracy that has actually led the way in instituting deliberative polling. I'm not one of those people who thinks that these methods should replace democracy of elections. People have died for the opportunity to vote in elections, but we can make our elections more thoughtful and we can make our constitutional processes more thoughtful. And that's what deliberative democracy. Well, there are two models of deliberative democracy. One is consensus driven, where the product of the deliberation is an agreed statement, like a jury verdict or a written statement. That's what the assemblies do, including the Citizens' Convention on the Climate that was in France. We don't do that because all the critiques of deliberative democracy come out of the jury literature. The jury is one of the most studied deliberative institutions in the world. And the social pressure to get a verdict or a consensus distorts the process. So we get our results in confidential questionnaires before and after. People don't ever have to say how they come out on the issue. There's no show of hands. And so if a group has views that are different from the others, they're perfectly free and should feel perfectly free to express those in the questionnaires. And so we get the exact state of opinion before deliberation and after, and we have large enough samples that we can study it in a statistically meaningful way, as opposed to citizens' juries or even the so-called citizens' assemblies, which often have 100 or maybe 150. We use larger numbers. And we also have control groups so that we can compare the people who never have to make the effort to spend a weekend deliberating or make a trip to the site, whether it's Washington, D.C. or the capital city of Mongolia or whatever. The control group just has to answer the questionnaire before and after. So in that case, we leave room for dissensus. But if there is a consensus, it comes out in the results. It comes out in the data. And very often there is. But it's not a forced consensus with the social pressure of people feeling they have to go along with the rest of the crew. Oh, well, I don't know if I can offer general advice, except think for yourself. Question the news sources that you get exposed to willy-nilly by algorithms. Question the sources. And if you're interested in a topic, do some of your own research, but do it with some validation. You know, the major newspapers have databases of claims that they've fact-checked, and there's so much misinformation and disinformation that you can get exposed to, and well-meaning people can turn into conspiracy theorists if they're not careful. So you have to be self-critical. The habits of thinking for yourself are very hard to develop currently, but that's what we need of all citizens.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.